Well, turn with me, please, to the passage that we read a minute ago, Deuteronomy chapter 3, verses 21 to 29, as we continue our studies in this book of Deuteronomy. Now, it would be very easy, I suppose, to overlook this little passage that we're considering this morning. It would be very easy just to race on into Deuteronomy chapter 4. But I think it would be a shame to do that. I think it's a very moving little passage, and more importantly, I think it's an instructive little passage from which, by God's help, I hope that we can benefit a little this morning. The passage is really all about Moses. Moses, of course, is the preacher who is delivering this huge sermon which we call Deuteronomy. It's his voice that we're hearing every time that we open this book. And you remember how in this section then, from chapter 1, verse 6, to the end of chapter 3 here, Moses, we said last time, is giving the Israelites, as it were, a history lesson. He's recounting the main events that have taken place since the Israelites left Mount Sinai. He's walking them through their recent past. And this particular episode, with which he here closes the history lesson, it specifically concerns himself. It's on a decidedly personal note that he brings this section of Deuteronomy to an end. And so all I want to do this morning is draw your attention to four things which emerge about Moses. Four things about Moses which emerge from this passage that we are considering. First of all then, notice that Moses is a dispensable man. Moses is a dispensable man. Well, this last week then we've had the death, haven't we, of Ted Kennedy in the United States. And I've been very intrigued by all these hugely glowing tributes that have been pouring in from all quarters. Because you remember, of course, that back in 1980, Ted Kennedy couldn't even secure the backing of his own political party. That year he made a bid to be the presidential candidate for the Democratic Party. And you remember how he was beaten, hands down, by Jimmy Carter, partly because 10 years earlier there'd been a scandal in his life, and partly because his electoral campaign simply wasn't convincing. And yet, here we are, three decades later, and as the man dies, you would think, from what has been said, that he was the greatest politician that the world has ever seen. And I wouldn't be at all surprised if something similar to that was going on amongst the Israelites here. Even though there was a point at which the Israelites had lost confidence in Moses to such an extent that they were actually looking for a replacement leader to take them back to Egypt, yet here, 40 years down the line, four decades later, as Moses is about to die, and as he's about to pass the baton on to his successor Joshua, there may well have been an impulse amongst these Israelites to actually put the man on a pedestal now, to actually overstate his importance, to actually think that somehow Moses was indispensable and that his departure therefore signified the beginning of the end. But notice, you see, that Moses himself harboured no such thoughts, did he? Because look at how he speaks to Joshua in verses 21 and 22. Look at the confidence, the assurance, the sheer buoyancy of his language here. You have seen with your own eyes all that the Lord your God has done to these two kings. He's referring to Sihon and Og, the two kings whom Israel has defeated on the east side of the Jordan before crossing over to the promised land. The Lord, he continues, will do the same to all the kingdoms over there where you are going. That is in Canaan, in the promised land. Do not be afraid of them. The Lord your God himself will fight for you. And this emphasis, I think, is very important. Because remember what we said last time. Remember what the purpose of this history section from chapter 1, verse 6 to the end of chapter 3 is. Remember we said that Moses' purpose in this section is to stress the sheer grace of God in his dealings with Israel in their past. In chapter 4 and onwards, he's going to bombard Israel with a whole load of ethics, a whole load of laws, a whole load of commands. But before he comes to that, before he comes to all God's requirements, he wants to first of all place that in its context. And its context is this: God has been sensationally gracious to you, Israel. Remember that episode, and remember that episode, and remember that episode, and remember that episode. Everything that you have, Israel, you owe to his grace. All your successes, Israel, are because of his favor. You are where you are today, Israel, because of his goodness. You are debtors to mercy alone. And it's in the light of that, Israel, that you're to go out and keep all these laws that I'm about to give you over the ensuing chapter. So that's the point that Moses has been making, and he's been making it very compellingly. But there's still one more thing that he has to do. One more thing that he has to do if his whole purpose here isn't going to be undermined completely, and it's this. He has to strip the Israelites of any sense at all that it was actually Moses to whom they owed all their success. That it was actually because of Moses that they were where they were on this day. That it was actually because of all Moses' efforts that they had triumphed to this point and were about to cross over to the promised land. No, Moses had to disabuse them of that idea altogether. He had to strip them of any sense that he, their leader, was somehow indispensable. And so that's what he's doing here by recording this little speech that he'd given to Joshua. And he's effectively saying, look, it's God who has fought for you right up until this point. And it's God who will fight for you from this point onwards. It's God's grace that has carried you to this very moment. And it's God's grace that will continue to carry you on from here. And yes, to be sure, I may have had some little role in God's wisdom and in God's plan. But I, at the end of the day, am a thoroughly dispensable man. That's what Moses is saying in these verses. And it's a point which I think all of us need to take seriously and grasp this morning. We need to do it for two reasons. First of all, so that we won't idolize God's servants. One of John Calvin's biographers writes this: Calvin had given definite instructions for his funeral. Nothing must distinguish it from that of any other citizen. His body was to be sewed into a white shroud and laid in a simple pine coffin. At the grave there were to be neither words nor song. He did not even want a tombstone. Just a few months later, when foreign students desired to visit the place where the reformer's earthly remains rest, the place could no longer be pointed out among fresh mounds. And you think, well, why? Why didn't Calvin want pomp and ceremony to accompany his departure from this world? Well, the answer is because he understood that no less than Moses before him and George Whitefield and Charles Spurgeon and John Piper since him, he was a dispensable servant of God. Yes, he'd had a role to play, but he was dispensable. God had been working up until John Calvin's life, and God would continue to work beyond John Calvin's life. And so he didn't want pomp and ceremony, a song and a dance at his funeral. And we must never idolize any servants of God. We must be thankful, of course, for those individuals whom God has used in our experience. very thankful that he raised them up, that he brought them to us. But we must never think for one moment that such individuals are indispensable. We must never think that we ourselves are indispensable in any of our spheres of service. Moses wasn't, and neither is any other. So we mustn't idolize God's servants. But then the other reason it's important to grasp this principle is so that we'll have confidence in God. Remember Jesus' great words in John 5:17, "My Father is always at his work. My Father is always at his work." Now, it's good to have a healthy interest in church history, but we must never let ourselves slip into some kind of gloomy nostalgia, whereby we're always talking about the good old days of the early church, the good old days of the Reformation, the good old days of the evangelical revivals. Oh, what a shame that we live in such miserable days today. No. My Father is always at his work. God is irresistibly working everything toward the fulfillment of his eternal purposes. God is unstoppably building his church and spreading his gospel and bringing all things nearer and nearer that day when his Son will return in splendor and in glory. And yes, to be sure, people will come and go. Human personnel will always be changing. God will continue doing what he has always set out to do. He was in Moses' day. He was in Joshua's day. He was in Calvin's day. He is in our day. And he will still be doing what he has set out to do 1,000 years from now if Christ hasn't yet returned. And even then, the most eminent and the most gifted and the most used servants of God are dispensable. Because of this, God is always at his work, always fulfilling his purposes, always bringing everything nearer to that grand day of consummation. And nothing can thwart him, nothing can hinder him. No death, no retirement, no transition, no development can derail God as he carries out all that he has eternally set out to do. That's the first thing then we see about Moses. He was a dispensable man. But then secondly, Moses was a disappointed man. Moses was a disappointed man. Because look then at verses 23 to 25. In these verses, we have Moses praying. And what Moses is praying for is expressed in verse 25, in that petition, "Let me go over and see the good land beyond the Jordan, that fine hill country and Lebanon." And the background to this prayer then is a situation which Moses has already commented on in this sermon back in chapter 1, verse 37. The context there is God's announcement to that whole Exodus generation of Israelites, that because of your disobedience, because of your rebellion, you are not going to enter the promised land after all. And Moses just adds in verse 37 then of chapter 1, "Because of you, the Lord became angry with me also and said, you shall not enter it either." And here in this prayer then in chapter 3, Moses is simply praying that God might overturn that previous decision concerning himself, and that God might yet allow Moses to enter the land of Canaan after all. But the thing that I really want you to notice about this is one word that Moses uses in verse 23, and it's the word pleaded. "At that time I pleaded with the Lord." And I find this intriguing because I suppose that if we were asked to name the top 10 sufferers in the Bible, I don't suppose Moses would make it on that list, would he? Moses wasn't stripped of everything he had like Job was. He was never commanded to sacrifice his son on top of a mountain like Abraham was. He was never martyred like Stephen was. He was never a childless mother like Hannah was. He was never sold into slavery like Joseph was. He was never shipwrecked like Paul was. He was never given the wrong woman as his bride like Jacob was. He was never thrown into the middle of the sea like Jonah was. And so we could go on. Moses wasn't like that colleague that you have at work perhaps who is never actually there because there always seems to be some new crisis blowing up in his life and he just seems to stagger from one problem to the next. Moses wasn't like that. Moses was this stable figure at Israel's helm over all those years. Moses was sorted. Moses, it seems, just took everything in his strides. But here you see, in Deuteronomy 3, we're given this little window, aren't we, into Moses' private prayer times. And we suddenly discover that Moses too had his burden to bear. We suddenly discover that this exclusion from the promised land, this personal exclusion, commented on so sparingly and so matter-of-factly back there in chapter 1, verse 37, it was actually a crushing disappointment and a devastating blow to this man. Dale Ralph Davis, whom some of you heard a few weeks ago at Keswick, he recalls how one day when he was about 17 or 18, he was with his mother in the kitchen of their home. His mother was washing the dishes. He was drying them. For a few moments, there was no particular conversation between them. But then the silence was broken by his mother just making one comment, and it was this: "I miss my father. I miss my father." Now, Dereoff Davis was astonished by this because his grandfather had died some 30 or 40 years earlier. Here was this 60-year-old woman, you see. Outwardly, no doubt, very contented and very untroubled. You wouldn't have labelled her a sufferer. And yet, inwardly, in her heart, there was still this raw nerve. There was still this sense of loss, which the passage of time hadn't removed. And it reminds us, doesn't it, that this is the case generally. This is the case with so many of the people that you and I rub shoulders with every day. It's the case with so many of us, no doubt, this morning. And it reminds us not to jump to simplistic assessments of one another based on superficial appearances. Moses here, Deraf Davis's mother, it reminds us not to just assume that everything is fine with everyone else around us. Not to just assume that that person over there, well, they have it easy. That brother over there, well, he just finds it plain sailing. That sister over there, well, she has no particular problems to deal with in her life. It reminds us that we simply don't know what's going on in the hidden regions of those people's lives. We simply don't know the heartaches that those people are struggling with, the wounds that those people are nursing, the tears that those people are shedding, the prayers that those people are praying. Behind the scenes, beneath the surface, behind the cheerful smiles and the composed body language and the ordinary performance of external routines can be lurking all kinds of heartaches and anxieties and regrets. And they may only ever be expressed behind closed doors before the throne of Almighty God, but they are there nonetheless. Plato, whom I suppose I don't often quote, had a very wise proverb, which was this: be kind, for everyone you meet is fighting a hard battle. Be kind, for everyone you meet is fighting a hard battle. And that's no less true in the life of the church. It's no less true within the church of Jesus Christ. And in all likelihood, the person even that you're sitting next to this morning, whatever the external appearance, in some sense at least, is a hurting person. And in all our conversations then, and in all our prayers, we ought to take that into account. Moses outwardly didn't seem like he was a suffering man. Inwardly, this heartache, this disappointment that was crushing him and gnawing at him and driving him to passionate, desperate prayer in private. And it's so often the way with God's people. And it ought to make us very sensitive and very gentle and very pastoral in the way that we deal with our brothers and sisters. But just one other thing as well before we move on here. Notice the response which Moses gets to his prayer. There in verse 26, the middle of the verse, "The Lord would not listen to me. That is enough, the Lord said. Do not speak to me any more about this matter." In other words, God didn't relieve Moses of this disappointment. In fact, he only exacerbates it here. He only deepens it. In a word, his response to Moses' pleading prayer was no. Simple as that. No. A week past Wednesday, we were thinking about John Calvin's treatment of the subject of prayer. And we saw there all the incentives that he produced for prayer. And we said that they were wonderful incentives. The fact that God has provided a mediator for us, his son, Jesus Christ. The fact that God relates to us as a father. The fact that God has an indulgent, merciful character. And we said that these are wonderful incentives and we need to grasp them and so pray with greater confidence and boldness than we often do. And indeed, we must. But at the same time, we must also have a place in our theology of prayer for this. God sometimes says no. Not you need to pray more persistently. You need to pray more passionately. You need to pray more urgently. You need to pray more eloquently. But simply, no, I'm not giving you what you're requesting. Because you see, at the end of the day, yes, God has provided a mediator. Yes, God relates to us as a father. Yes, God has an indulgent character, and that is wonderful. But God is also a sovereign God. He's the sovereign ruler of the universe. He's the King of kings and the Lord of lords. He's not our errand boy. He's not our butler. He doesn't exist for our personal convenience. And prayer, therefore, is never some kind of magic formula which somehow ties God's hands and manipulates him to do exactly what we want him to do. You can pray and pray that you might be able to go to that university which you want to go to, and God might still say no. You can pray and pray that you might be able to marry that boy, that girl that you want to marry, and God might still say no. You can pray and pray that you might be delivered from that illness, that condition, that disease, and God might still say no. You can pray and pray that you might have a child and God might still say no. Some of you may have come across that little book by James W. Bruce, an American believer whose son died in infancy. He was only 55 days old when he died. John Cameron Bruce was the name of the little boy. And in this book, I think it's in its latest incarnation entitled From Grief to Glory. In this little book, James Bruce records some of his diary entries, some of his journal entries from the time of his little son's life and death. And this is one of them. He writes, "John Cameron died on Sunday, March the 16th at 9:21 in the evening. He died in the arms of his mother and father. Our last act as parents was to commend him and ourselves to Christ and his good keeping." And then he writes this, "John's death is one of the most profound experiences of my life, for we wrestled with things of an eternal nature. All during his life, I prayed that God would either grant him life and health or spare us from the difficult decisions. But God did neither." God did neither. That's the stark reality that Moses was coming up against here. And all of us will from time to time. And sometimes we must simply go back to Martin Luther's great saying, "Let God be God. Sometimes we can go no further than that. Sometimes we can probe no deeper than that. We must simply rest on his sovereignty. Let God be God. Moses was a disappointed man. Thirdly, this morning, Moses was a discerning man. He was a discerning man. Because on the face of things, we seem to have here a terrible tragedy, don't we? Here's this man, Moses, and he has invested so much of his life in leading others to this land of Canaan with all its beauty and all its fertility and all its physical assets. And yet he himself isn't going to enjoy a single little bit of it. He isn't going to enjoy so much as a single grape. Not so much as a single olive. Not so much as a single fig. Not so much as a single taste of the famous milk and honey. He's led all these Israelites there over all these years. And he himself isn't going to participate in it. What a ghastly situation Moses is in, surely. Surely you can't get a more pitiful sight than the one we have in verse 27. Moses there climbing up this mountain and looking out on the land, looking at all those blessings and benefits which he himself isn't going to participate in. You can just imagine how a Hollywood film director would play that scene, the music that would accompany it. What a tragedy, surely, we have here. But it seems to me that we have to place this passage here, we have to place this episode here, in the context of Moses' life as a whole. Because you see, if Moses was motivated by beauty and fertility and physical assets, if Moses was driven by grapes and olives and figs and milk and honey, if what made Moses tick was all that this world has to offer, then Moses would never have left his upbringing in the palace of Egypt, would he? You remember what the writer to the Hebrews says in chapter 11 and verse 26. He talks there about the treasures of Egypt in connection with Moses. The treasures of Egypt, which Moses, during his upbringing, had at his disposal. They were there, available to him. They were there for his taking, all the treasures of this ancient superpower, Egypt. He was a prince growing up in the palace. But why didn't he take them? Well, the writer to the Hebrews tells us in that verse, doesn't he? He says, verse 26, Hebrews 11, Moses regarded disgrace for the sake of Christ as of greater value than the treasures of Egypt. Why? Because he was looking ahead to his reward. He was looking ahead to his reward. And in the context of Hebrews 11, his reward can only be the city with foundations in verse 10 and the heavenly country in verse 16, which Abraham similarly had set his eyes upon. In other words, the glories that God has lined up for his people beyond this life. In other words, you see, Moses was a discerning man. Moses had discerned that there's something beyond this life. He had discerned, in the words of Isaac Watts, that there is a land of pure delight where saints immortal dwell. And he had discerned that its delights, its glories, its riches are infinitely more worthwhile than anything that this world has to offer, anything even that Egypt and the palace of Egypt and the royal family of Egypt had to offer. And this, you see, is my point. That the same Moses who in the last analysis didn't need the treasures of Egypt because he had something better in view, similarly didn't need the treasures of Canaan either, the treasures of the promised land either, because he had something better in view. And yes, of course, Moses was only human. And so at some levels he would have loved to cross over into Canaan and experience something of its treasures and delights. As we've already said, there was real disappointment in his heart. But it was only disappointment. It wasn't a tragedy. It wasn't a tragedy for Moses that he wasn't going to cross over into Canaan. Because this world's treasures, this world's pleasures, this world's beauties were for Moses in proportion. And he knew that he was heading for a better place with treasures that far outweighed them all. John Piper comments on the day that his church there in the States heard of the deaths of Ruby Eliason and Laura Edwards in Cameroon. This is what he comments. He says, Ruby was over 80. Single all her life, she poured it out for one great thing, to make Jesus Christ known among the unreached, the poor, and the sick. Laura was a widow, a medical doctor, pushing 80 years old, and serving at Ruby's side in Cameroon. The brakes failed, the car went over the cliff, and they were both killed instantly. And Piper continues, I asked my people, was that a tragedy? Two lives, driven by one great vision, spent in unheralded service to the perishing poor for the glory of Jesus Christ. 2 decades after almost all their American counterparts have retired to throw their lives away on trifles in Florida or New Mexico. No, that is not a tragedy. That is a glory. And you see what Piper is saying? He's saying that here are these two women, and on the face of things here again, we have a tragedy. These two women, and as Piper says, they're at an age when all their American counterparts are indulging in luxury and affluence. And these two women, they haven't yet sampled one single little bit of the whole Florida retirement package. And suddenly their lives are wiped out like that in a car accident. What a tragedy. What a terrible tragedy it seems. And yet, Piper is saying, no, it's no tragedy. Because like Moses, these were discerning women. Like Moses, they had discerned that there's something beyond this life. That there is a land of pure delight where saints immortal dwell. They had discerned that its glories far outweigh any of the treasures of any Florida retirement package. And they had their eyes set on that better country to come. Piper actually continues, and he says this, I will tell you what a tragedy is. I will show you how to waste your life. Consider a story from the February 1998 edition of Reader's Digest, which tells about a couple who took early retirement from their jobs in the Northeast 5 years ago, when he was 59 and she was 51. Now they live in Punta Gorda, Florida, where they cruise on their 30-foot trawler, play softball, and collect shells. At first, Piper says, when I read it, I thought it might be a joke, a spoof on the American dream. But it wasn't. Tragically, this was the dream. Come to the end of your life, your one and only precious God-given life, and let the last great work of your life, before you give an account to your Creator, be this, playing softball and collecting shells. Picture them before Christ at the great day of judgment. Look, Lord, see my shells. That, he says, is a tragedy. And I just want to ask you this morning, who are you most like? Are you most like this couple in the Reader's Digest? Are you just accumulating all that this world has to offer, surrounding yourselves with comforts and luxuries as you hurtle toward that day when you will stand before your Maker and give an account? That is a tragedy of eternal proportions. Or are you like those two ladies in Cameroon? And like Moses here, are you happy even if you die not possessing half the things that this world says you must possess? Happy if you die not having achieved half the goals that this world says you must achieve? Because your sights are set on something beyond. The only reward that matters to you is the eternal inheritance which God has prepared for those who love him. Moses was a discerning man. I pray that all of you this morning might be discerning men and women, boys and girls. One last thing about Moses. He was a distinctive man. He was a distinctive man. Much of what we've said then this morning about Moses applies to us as well, doesn't it? He was a dispensable man. We've said that we too, all of us, are dispensable. He was a disappointed man. We've said that many of us suffer through life all kinds of disappointments and heartaches. He was a discerning man. I've said that that is my prayer for all of us, that we might be discerning people. But there's one thing, there's one detail in this passage to which we can't really relate in that same way. One detail which is distinctive to Moses. And it's the one we find at the beginning of verse 26, that little comment, "But because of you, the Lord was angry with me." Because of you, the Lord was angry with me. Now there's some ambiguity, I suppose, because elsewhere it seems as though Moses' exclusion from Canaan was because of his own faults, his own rebellion, his own conduct in one particular situation. But here in Deuteronomy, both in chapter 1 there and here in chapter 3, that's not the emphasis. The emphasis in Deuteronomy is that Moses' exclusion from the land of Canaan was on account of Israel's rebellion, Israel's faults, Israel's sins. So the picture that we're meant to get then in Deuteronomy is this. It's a picture of all these sinful and undeserving Israelites flooding over the border into the land of Canaan, enjoying this beautiful inheritance, enjoying God's blessing and God's favor and God's smile. Why? Because there is a lonely figure standing on Mount Pisgah, a lonely figure called Moses, who has experienced God's anger in their place, and who has experienced God's exclusion, that they might go in and enjoy the land. That's the picture that we're meant to get in Deuteronomy. And of course, many of us this morning are in a similar situation, aren't we? Many of us this morning are men and women, boys and girls, who are enjoying God's smile, God's favour, God's blessing, God's welcome. We are heading unstoppably toward the promised land, the land of pure delight. Why? Because 2,000 years ago, a lonely man stood on Mount Calvary and took God's anger that we deserve, and was excluded from heaven, excluded from the Father's fellowship and presence, excluded in the deepest dungeons of hell that day, that we might participate, that we might go in, that all heaven might be ours. You see, I'll close with this. Sin always arouses God's anger. It always does. God is a holy God. He cannot abide sin. Sin always arouses God's anger. The sin in your life arouses God's anger. The selfishness, the putting of other things in the place of God, the lying, all the different sins in your life, sin always arouses God's anger. And this means, you see, that on that day when we finally stand before God, and we all will, on that day, one of two scenarios will take place. Either God will say to us, "I am angry with you because of your sin, and you are going to experience the expression of my anger now forever and ever with no end whatsoever." That's one possible scenario. Or the other possible scenario is that on that day, someone else will stand there alongside us before the throne of God, the Lord Jesus Christ, and he will say, echoing Moses' words from all those centuries ago, "Because of you, the Lord was angry with me." there at Calvary because of you. The Lord was angry with me. And that means there's no more anger for you. There's no anger left for him to pour out on you. It was all poured out on me. Because of you, he was angry to the ultimate degree with me. He battered me. He crushed me. He devastated me with his anger there on Calvary's cross. Now for you, there is only the blessing of an eternity of happiness in glory. Which is it going to be for you? God saying, I am angry with you. Or Jesus saying, because of you, he was angry with me. I trust that for all of you, it will be the latter scenario. May God bless his word to us. Amen. Well, let's close singing 509. And can it be that I should gain an interest in the Saviour's blood?